Okay, hi, welcome back. Welcome to the first day of LCA 2005. Before I pass you back to Ted, I'd just like to say a word about the wireless network here. So wireless is not a secure networking technology, and somebody is behaving unethically with the network here, running a rogue access point. So I'll just take this opportunity to remind you not to trust any data that comes off the network and not to send any unencrypted data. You need to be aware that DNS responses you get back may not be pointing where they should be pointing, so don't do any internet banking or anything like that across the network, probably. In general, don't use or don't trust any protocol except for something that is encrypted and authenticated, so basically SSL or SSH, where you already know the key of the machine that you're going to and it's trusted. So if you get SSH saying his host key is not known or this host key has changed, then for heaven's sake, don't say yes to that prompt. Say no. Somebody is apparently sniffing passwords, so if you see them, break their fingers. And if you're that person, then, come on, act like a grown-up. Don't be a dick. If you are caught, you'll be kicked out and the police will be called. So. Okay, so now I hand you back to Ted. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I'll just say that it used to be the case that people could actually be proving a point by demonstrating that they could, create a road access point and do man-in-the-middle attacks. And, we're not proving anything new. This is something we all know. The technology is just really dodgy, and we're waiting for secure wireless to become, widespread. So it's not like you're proving anything by doing that. I'm sure whoever has such bad taste is probably not in this room. But okay, so let me move on. I got two people asking this question during the break, so I thought I would just answer it. I guess I probably went a bit too quickly. And the question was, well, what's in the superblock? The superblock contains the core information of how the file system is configured. There's a magic number that identifies this is, yes, indeed, it really is an EXT2 file system. This is the number of blocks. This is the block size. This is how many inodes are in it. It's all the core information about the parameters of the file system. Let me just show you what's actually in there. This is a sample file system which I'm using the command dump e2fs, and it's showing you everything in here is information that's actually in an EXT2 file system. So what file system features are in the file system? We have a fairly expressive and robust system for indicating what features are added and whether the features are backwards compatible or not. The number of blocks, the number of inodes, what the first block is that's used, when the file system was created, last time it was mounted, the last time the super block was modified, all sorts of random information. And then for each block group, we store information about where the block descriptors are, where the bitmap is, the inode bitmap, the inode table, and then here there's information that's actually in the block allocation bitmaps of what blocks are free, what inodes are free, and this is the dump e2fs program. It's a nice program if you want to sort of peer at a file system and see what's going on. It's a nice little quick tool. So with that, I'm just going to very quickly talk about a couple of common Linux file systems that are used on Linux systems, and then I'm going to close out the file system talk. And again, we only have 3 hours together, so I can't go into a whole lot of details about all of these things. We've talked a little bit about ReiserFS already. Hans Reiser has this belief that file systems and databases should be unified. So he believes that, for example, there should not be an inetd.conf file. Instead, there should be an inetd.conf directory. And in that directory, you might have directories called telnet and smtp. And inside the telnet directory, you might have port. And the contents of port might be the bytes 2, 3. And you might have protocol, and that protocol might be TCP or UDP. So his basic thing is, why write complicated parsing functions? Just use really, really tiny files that contain the information you need, and you can sort of treat it as a database, which is why I've sometimes flippantly said that RiserFS is the perfect file system if what you want to store in it is a Windows registry. The downside of that particular scheme is that you take system call overheads every single time you want to read, you know, each of these little tiny bytes. And so Hans's solution to that is that you ought to be able to download code into the kernel so that you can read multiple files all at once, return them in a buffer. But wait, once you do that, what do you have to do? You have to parse the buffer. So you end up writing the parsing code in your application all over again. And so that particular part of the design has not been well received by the rest of the Linux kernel developers, and we don't see any applications that actually code use a whole set of little tiny files in a Windows registry-like system instead of just simply using a flat file for their configuration. But that's certainly where Hans wants to go. And in RiserFS 4, there actually is this YAC lex parser for this command language so that you can download programs into the kernel. But it's not clear that's ever going to get accepted in the mainline. But, you know, that's where Hans wants to go with this. JFS is essentially a port of OS2, the OS2 JFS file system, which is not the original old AIX JFS file system. AIX now actually supports the OS2 JFS file system as well. Basically, the original old, the original old AIX JFS file system was contaminated with some Veritas code. And so when they implemented OS2, what they did was they took that design team and they did a clean room re-implementation from scratch, from first principles. So there was the OS2 JFS and the AIX JFS, which were in fact not identical. And then I think over time what has happened is AIX supports both, and now most people, when they talk JFS, they all refer to the same thing. But there is some confusion there, so I just want to mention that. It's a very well-done file system. It has journaling. It uses B-tree for directories. It's compatible for OS2, which might be important to some people. For better or for worse, it just simply hasn't grabbed much community enthusiasm. I mean, it's a competently well-done file system, but, you know, it's out there. None of the distros are, you know, using it as the default file system, so it's just sort of there. But, you know, it's not a bad one, so it gets a bunch of things right. XFS is from the SGI IRIX system. It uses B-trees everywhere, and I mean everywhere, not just simply directories, but free space. There are two, count them, two directories for free space. One of them is indexed by the block number, and the other one is indexed by the size of the free extent. And they use delayed allocation, so if you're going to write a six-block file, it will actually search the B-tree to find six free blocks and try to squidgy it in to exactly the right free space. And it's basically designed for, you know, to be as scalable as possible, and basically it's sort of the extreme file system. One of the side effects is that XFS has a very, very, very large code base. I think it was Daniel Phillips who flippantly commented that the entire ext2 file system is smaller than XFS's B-tree implementation. So, you know, be that as it may. ext3 was basically just simply, we used a new name just so that we could have both the old ext2, which was guaranteed to be stable, and ext3 in the 2.4 code base at the same time. And over time, we've just been adding more and more features to ext3. The original reason why we did that branch was for journaling support. We've since added a hashed, I really shouldn't call it B-tree, it's a hashed binary tree that's actually not balanced for fast lookups. Pre-allocation is now in 2.6, and online resizing is in 2.6. But as of the time when I had to submit these slides to LCA, they hadn't quite hit mainline yet, but the patches have been around for a long time. In fact, if you were using Fedora, they've been in Fedora for quite a while, but I believe they hit 2.6 as of 2.6.10. So we have those features there now. There are a bunch of other features that we're thinking about adding, including delayed allocation and some extent handling. And again, all of you should go to Ottawa, and you'll hear more about those subjects then. So let me very quickly talk about log structured file systems. And this is just one of a whole bunch of weird file systems I just want to mention are out there. Not everything is an inode-based file system or a FAT-based file system. Everything we've talked about now are what are called update-in-place file systems, which means when you modify a block in a file, you just simply overwrite it. Very, very simple, not particularly hard. Log structured file systems are different. They actually take the complete reverse point of view, which is that you never overwrite an allocated block. You might replace it with a new block that might contain new data, but you never overwrite an existing block. And in the BSD log structured file system, blocks are always added at the end of the log, which makes writes very fast because you never have to seek around when you're writing. So if we want to modify a block in a data file, what we have to do is allocate a new block, modify it, but now what we have to do is find the block that contains the inode that might have a pointer to that data block and replace that block so that we now have a version of the inode that points to the new data block. Now we have to find the directory entry that points to the inode and replace that. And then if that directory has a parent directory, so on and so forth, so you end up replacing all the metadata blocks until you replace the root directory. All right? And this may sound really horrible, but all the writes are contiguous because you just simply append to the end of the log, hence the name log structured file system. Yeah, question in the back. I'm not actually sure how they actually handle that. They may actually have a mapping table for the inode table, and you have to update that. At least one of the log structured file systems, you actually modified the directory entry. I don't think they supported hard links. I don't remember what the BSD LFS does, but there are a couple of different variants on this particular scheme. But the basic concept is you just simply keep replacing until you get up to the root. RiserFS does that as well. And I'll talk about some of the disadvantages of this whole class of file systems in a little bit, which is why I have some doubts about Riser 4. Because of how LFS works, it's basically always appending new versions of inodes, data blocks, whatever, to the end of the circular log, which implies that you always have to have free space so you can write all these replacement replacement blocks. So what you need is you need to have a log cleaner that coalesces the free space so that if you have used blocks that are sort of fragmented, you copy them to the head of the log. In order to you to have free space at the log for you to append additional blocks. Now, how you do the log cleaner is critical to the LFS's file performance because if you do it while your system is busy, you slow down performance. But if you don't do it frequently enough, then you run out of space to actually write new data blocks. So. What are some of the problems with LFS? A lot of them have to do with performance, right? The original LFS design assumed that disk seeks were very, very expensive and that writes were cheap, which is in fact true. If you're just simply writing contiguously, that's pretty cheap compared to the cost of actually seeking around. They also assumed that you can have huge amounts of memory and so that caching can make up for really disastrous disastrous read performance. So with LFS, as long as your log cleaner can actually keep free space around, writing is very, very fast because there are no seeks. Even if you end up having to rewrite all these data blocks, it's a contiguous write. So it's very, very fast. The problem is the directories get fragmented all over the place because you're constantly rewriting aspects of the directory, which means that unless you can actually keep all of your directories and all of your commonly used data blocks in memory and cached, because the file system is completely fragmented and all over the place, read performance is really, really, really slow. And while memory has been getting bigger and bigger, so has bloatware. I now have a 2-gig laptop, 2 gigs of physical memory in my laptop, but Mozilla and Java eats up most of it, thank you very much. I don't necessarily have a lot of free memory available to cache disk blocks. So LFS has generally failed either because, from a performance perspective, either because seeks are now, you end up seeking all over the place to read and you don't have the right things in cache, or because the log cleaner can't keep up. So this is the real problem, is read performance, because LFS scatters the directories all around, and the memory caching has just, in practice, not particularly worked out very well. I'll note that many of the Riser 4 initial benchmarks were untar a kernel source tree into Riser 4 and then read from it again. And everything was actually in memory. Some of the benchmarks for Riser 4 are in fact very, very sensitive in that you only got the good performance if you created the tar file in a very, very special order that was specific to Riser 4. Whether or not that represents a cooked benchmark, I'll leave it for you to decide. In general, be careful about benchmarks because, as the old saying goes, there are lies, there are damn lies, there are statistics, and then there are benchmarks. And somewhere after that are like analyst reports, but So there are a whole bunch of other non-update-in-place file systems that aren't strictly speaking log structure, but they try to never reallocate blocks. The waffle file system, which is used by network appliances, is one. That's a technique which they call shadow page file systems. Won't talk a whole lot about it. I'll note that they actually have a fair amount of patents in that particular space. Daniel Phillips had a TUX2 file system that used a phase tree approach that was somewhat similar. As far as I know, that never really got anywhere, but it was something that he was playing with. So that's about all I'm going to talk about with file systems. And now, with all of that base history, I'm going to go back to our original question, which is, how do we actually recover from file system accidents? Once again, ask yourself, how did this happen? And now, the next question is, what's the lowest level that was corrupted? Did you lose the hard drive itself? Is the partition table corrupt? Is it a file system level error? Is it, an actual application, BurkDB file that's been corrupted? An important thing to remember is that, in general, tools assume that everything below it is in fact working just fine. So if you're using, for example, a file system consistency checker, such as E2FSCK or FSCK, it is going to assume that the hard drive is fundamentally sane, that if you write a block, you will get the same data back when you read it later, and that the partition table is correct. If the partition table is not correct, then FSCK might report that your file system is totally scrambled. But yet, it might be really trivial to fix, and before you panic and start reformatting your disk and all the rest, you might want to double check and make sure that your partition table is sane. All right, so that's why asking yourself the question, what level got corrupted, and in particular, what's the lowest level that got corrupted, is really, really important. again, how important is the data, so you understand to what links you're willing to go to try to get the data back. When was the last time you performed backups, which hopefully was just last night, right? So, and then, you know, create a plan of attack before you do anything else. Basically, you know, think ahead. So, you know, here's the levels. Figure out, you know, what level might have been corrupted. If the problem is at the hard drive, very often if you look in the system logs, there will be hints to that effect. Here are some examples. These are IDE errors, DMA interrupt status. I apologize that this is very, very hard to understand because this was written by a kernel programmer, and kernel programmers generally don't study issues like usability or understandability. But this is sort of a hint that, in fact, on HDA 3, there's the major and minor number, 03:03, that we've got an error at sector 1204. And you can see here in the line above, this is actually all from one error, that the LBA sector, that's the offset from the beginning of the disk. And sector 1204 is the offset from the beginning of the partition, which is, in fact, probably the much more useful number. Here's some more examples. If you have a bad CRC message, if you're using a UDMA IDE controller, you can get errors such as this, DMA inner, what was it there? Bad CRC. And in general, that's a hint that maybe your controller cable is loose or you have to replace your controller cable. You know, many of these errors, you know, if your system has been working fine and you're not, you know, carrying it around with you, you know, to LAN parties or whatnot, you know, in general, controller cables don't get unseated. Now, of course, if you live in the Bay Area and you've been having earthquakes, you know, all bets are off. But, you know, in general, if the system is working, you know, you generally won't have things go bad on you. But, you know, as always, you can always be surprised. SCSI errors are, use a completely different format. And again, this is because kernel programmers don't understand concepts like usability, and so they expect that humans aren't supposed to be reading this, but of course humans have to. So this is error. Major device 8 is your SCSI device, and this would be SDB3. The first digit indicates that it's drive B, because if it was SDA, that would be a 0. And then the second hex nibble indicates that it's the third partition. So an important thing to do if you see error logs is to go back in time and try to see if you can find any kind of pattern. Right? Was this an isolated case? Are you seeing a large number of errors that have been increasing over time, which is sort of a hint I mentioned earlier, to you might have a massive hardware failure. If you have SMART, this is a relatively modern disk, checking the smart logs is a really good thing to do. And if you come to the conclusion that the disk might be failing, again, do a complete backup before you do anything else. And an image backup is the best way to go. I've already talked about the DD command. Someone asked, why is it that we're doing HDA1, HDB1, as opposed to just simply backing up HDA to HDB? Of course, you can do that, but very often there's no point backing up, like, say, a swap partition. And I just find that it's better from a fine-grained control to just simply back up each partition one at a time. Another tool you can use is DD Rescue, which is a much more user-friendly tool. It's faster because instead of reading in 1K chunks at a time, it will actually use a larger block size. But then if it gets an error, it will retry with a smaller block size and back off. So it's much faster in the general case while still copying all the data. And you don't have to type con sync comma no error. It's a lot more user-friendly. It also appears faster because there's a progress bar. Right. Everybody knows progress bar at least makes it appear like it goes faster. And so you know, okay, are we, you know, 10% of the way in or 90% of the way in? Do I have time to go get a cup of coffee or maybe, you know, a good stiff drink of whiskey? You can find that at Kurt Garloff's website. And he wrote it because he had to deal with a hardware failure, so it's been optimized for that. Yeah, question? Yes. Yes, it does. Yeah. It does all the right things. So, as far as I know, most distros have not started packaging DD Rescue. I think it's in Debian, but I'm not sure it's... it's a really nice tool, so it's definitely worth getting. The reason why I include the DD command is if your distro doesn't have it, in the heat of the moment, it's probably better just simply to use DD than to try to, you know, download a new tool and then compile it and then try to use it. But, you know, if you do have time, you know, familiarizing yourself with DD Rescue might be a good thing. Yeah, question? Careful, and unfortunately, some seek errors mean that, and some seek errors are just simply because the information on how to actually locate a particular drive is smushed, and so it's sometimes difficult to distinguish between those two. Yeah. Question. Trying to remember if there's a way to do it without recompiling the driver. It's in the driver to retry, and I think the normal is 3 times, which isn't that bad, except if there's an error, the hard drive takes a long time to try internally before the disk driver retries a second 3 times. Well, the file system would retry every single time it tried to read from that inode table. That won't happen if you're doing an image level backup, because then you'll only retry once as you're just simply copying that one file across. And that's another reason why, if you believe that you've got hardware problems, don't run FSCK on the failing disk, right? Back it up, do a full image backup, and then run FSCK on a known good disk. I can't remember off the top of my head if there's a good way to actually crank that down other than recompiling the driver. I think one of the drivers had an option that you could give at the boot command line or when you load the module, but I don't remember the details. That's the sort of thing where I dive into the kernel sources when I need to know. So I don't know the answer off the top of my head, sorry. Okay, so let's move on. Completing what to do if the hard drive itself is dead, there are companies that will provide hard drive recovery services. Some of them basically will do what you can do once we're done with this class, which is logical data recovery. Others will actually have a clean room so they can take apart the disk and maybe replace the controller board or do something far more complex. Those services can be quite expensive because, you know, they're using a clean room and all sorts of specialized equipment. It's typically used by corporations where the value of the data is very, very high, and so they're willing to pay $10,000, $20,000 or, you know, whatever to actually recover the data. So one of the things you want to ask yourself is, you know, how valuable is this data? You know, how much would it cost if I have to simply reconstruct it all? You know, if you've got backups from 2 days ago, maybe it's not worth it to actually go to one of these recovery services. Another question is, how much time do you have? Some of these recovery services, you know, will take days or weeks or months Sometimes you pay more, they'll actually do it. They'll put you at the head of the line and expedite it. And then when you go to these recovery services, you really want to ask, what will they do? Are they only going to be doing logical recovery? Are they going to be have a clean room and actually recovering from a physically damaged disc? And ask how they charge. Some of these folks won't charge you anything if they can't get any data back, or they'll charge you a small initial fee, and if they're actually successful, then they'll actually charge you a lot more. Others will just simply charge strictly by the hour. So you want to find out up front how much this is actually likely going to cost, and then you can decide for yourself if it's actually worth doing. So if the hard drive is okay, the next level we worry about is whether the partition table is sane or not. And as I mentioned earlier, if the partition table is corrupt, you're not going to be able to find the file system, which means the kernel isn't going to be able to mount it, and FSCK may say, there's nothing here. And it may just simply be that the partition table is trashed. So one of the first things that you want to check if you get that kind of error is to look at the partition table. Does it look sane? One of the easiest way to do that is with fdisk-l, and this is one of the outputs. A really smart thing to do is to print out the output of fdisk-l on a tiny piece of paper and tape it to the side of your computer, right? So that, because this isn't a whole lot of information, but if you don't have that information, recovering from it can be painful. So backing up the partition table is a really good idea, and just simply using paper backups is pretty straightforward. Another thing you could do is just simply backing up the partition table. If you're using the master boot record, that's pretty easy. Just simply back up the first 512 bytes to a file. Now you want to store that file somewhere else, right? If you store it on the file system in the disk, then when the partition table is trashed, you won't be able to find the file. If you want to recover the partition table, and in the meantime you've already, say, replaced the bootloader with something else, then there's a magic DD command that will allow you to just replace the 64 bytes, which is the partition table, without disturbing the boot code. Otherwise, you could just simply DD the whole MBR record on. If you're using LILO, there may be a backup copy in the /boot directory. But you really don't want to rely on that, number one, because in order to get at it, your partition table needs to be sane enough to actually get at the file system. And number two, the LILO install scripts only update it at the time when you install LILO. And if you've updated the partition table since that point, they won't necessarily be reflected in these files. But it's a good place to look for them. Yeah, question? Right, that's exactly the problem. Okay, so now if you don't have a backup of the partition table, and I'm sure all of you right after this class will rush out and print out fdisk-l and tape it to the side of the disk, you can also try to use the program gpart. All right, and gpart is a program that will scan the disk and will look for things that look like file systems and try to intuit what the partition boundaries are. Now, gpart doesn't necessarily always work. If you've changed the partition table over time and you had old file systems that haven't been completely overwritten, gpart can get confused. On the other hand, if you don't have any other backups, it's amazing how often gpart mostly does the right thing. So it's a nice tool. If you have no other alternative, it's a good one to use, but as I said, you're much better off just simply backing up the partition table to begin with. Let's talk about problems at the LVM level. Fortunately, the LVM is very, very paranoid because it stores two copies of the metadata on every single physical volume. And then, on top of that, they also have a backup copy in /etc/LVM. So the metadata is backed up extensively. Probably a good idea to back up the contents of etc/LVM. If you have it backed up, then in case of some really utter horrible emergency that would probably be some kind of software bug that simultaneously wipes out all of your LVM metadata, you can back it up again with the VG config restore program. The much more likely LVM problem that you will run into is that one or more physical volumes in a volume group just die. Right? You have a volume group that consists of five disks, and one of them just had a hard drive failure. And this is the point where it's important to remind people that LVM and RAID are not the same things. Some LVM systems will allow you to do RAID. If so, think about using it, right? Because otherwise, if you don't, if you lose a physical volume and that physical volume isn't being backed up, either using an explicit backup system or via some sort of RAID-type system, you will very likely lose data when that hard drive crashes, right? Just if you have LVM and you're just simply using RAID 0, you are exposed. Now, how do you recover if a physical volume is truly gone? The simplest solution involves going to LVM 2 because its facilities are much better than LVM 1. And fortunately, LVM 2 is fully backwards compatible with LVM 1 as far as the metadata formats are concerned. LVM 2 does require device mapper, which is in 2.6. If you're using a 2.4 kernel, life gets a little bit trickier because you would have to update to a kernel that has device mapper patches and then upgrade to LVM 2. But LVM 2 has the ability to run a command that will allow you to mount the volume group with a known physical, with a physical volume missing, and replaced with dev 0. And what this will allow you to do is recover any logical volumes that partially span, that weren't missing because that one or more hard drives are actually gone. So you can sort of partially recover those volumes, and then once you've recovered what you can, and again, hopefully you have backups so this isn't a complete and utter disaster. VG reduce will remove those missing physical volumes from your metadata altogether, and then you can recover recover what's left. So this is what will get you back to a stable situation, but you'll probably have lost one or more logical volumes as a result of that hard drive dying. Now, if you're using RAID, that's not a problem because with RAID, you can just simply replace one, replace the failed disk, and it can hopefully rebuild from what's left. But if you're just simply using RAID 0, this is about the best that you can do. So let's get to file system corruption problems. File system corruption problems, most of the time, people notice it at one of two times. The first will be if FSCK actually notices it during the boot sequence, and you will see problems. If they're trivial, FSCK will just simply fix it and move on. If they're serious enough, it will actually abort the boot sequence so that a system administrator can take a look at the system and take some particular action. It can also happen if, while you're running, the system runs into an inconsistency, at which point the kernel will just simply report it. And you'll actually see these in the system logs. This is an example of one of them showing a corruption inside the directory. And basically it's saying the record locator isn't a multiple of 4 at that particular inode number. At that point, what happens is configurable. You can either configure a file system so that a kernel will just simply ignore an error. It'll just simply log it and move on. That's what I call the don't worry, be happy mode. I don't recommend it. But for some people, that may be the right answer. For most user-attended systems, like a desktop system or a laptop system, the one that probably works the best is remount the file system read-only, and that's the default. And in that mode, the file system that has the error will be remounted read-only, which means you won't be able to modify it, means you won't be able to cause any further damage. But any other file systems that might be also mounted on the system will still be okay. And this gives you an opportunity to, for example, save any open office files to another disk before you force a reboot and fix up the failed disk. For server machines or other unattended machines, the best approach may be to panic. All right, because if you've got a file system that's corrupted, the last thing you want to do is just sort of stumble along and further corrupt the file system or report bad answers. If you're running some sort of web server or some sort of database server. So panicking, force a reboot, and then let FSCK try to fix the damage is probably your best bet. And you can configure what will happen in the case of a corruption at runtime using the tune etufs command. Yeah, question. Quite a while ago. I'm not sure when. I'd have to go back. Pretty sure it's the default. I'll have to go check. I'm pretty sure the default is remount read only. So in the case of a consistency problem, FSCK is the primary tool for using it. It will do a automatic set of checks at boot time, but its strong emphasis is not losing any user data. And if there's something that might cause a potential security problem, it will abort the boot and force the user administrator to take manual action. An example of that is, for example, if you have an inode that is orphaned, so it's not actually belonging to a directory, FSCK can move that inode into the lost and found directory. Now, I get this question all the time, which is, why in the world is that something that I have to explicitly say yes to? Why can't FSCK do that automatically in the boot sequence? And the answer is very, very simple. Number one, that file which got moved into lost and found might be a critical system file. Or it might be a critical application config file or a critical application data file. And the administrator might want to check and see what that file is before letting the system come up the rest of the way. In addition, suppose you have a directory which is mode 700. Like, for example, my diary. Or my porn collection. And the file ends up dropped into lost and found. Well, that might actually defeat the security, because the file may have been read-only, but it might have been in a mode 700 directory. Older file systems used to have lost and found created mode 755, meaning that the directory was world-readable. And this was especially a problem in that case, because you might look in lost and found and find data which the file owners had originally thought was private because it was in a mode 700 directory. When it appeared in a world-readable directory, now anyone could read it. So a good thing to do after you run FSCK is to look at everything in lost and found and deal with it. Don't leave stuff to rot in lost and found. Debian, for example, will every 24 hours send a nagogram to the system administrator if there's anything in lost and found, because you really should clear that out. By the way, if you have a relatively recently created file system, the lost and found directory is now mode 700. And I highly recommend that, even if you follow the good practices and always clear it out. A good thing to check is make sure your lost and found directories are mode 700. If you created them using an older MakeFS, they might not be mode 700, and you really want to fix that. Yeah, question in back. Yeah, I probably could. I don't right now, but that might be a good idea to do. Is there something special about how the lost and found directory is placed on disk? No, it isn't. Traditionally, the MakeFS directory has pre-allocated blocks to make it simpler for FSCK to be able to insert into the lost and found directory. But in fact, at least in EXT2, the file system consistency checker is perfectly capable of extending the lost and found directory if it needs to. So we still pre-allocate blocks for lost and found, but it's not strictly necessary. Yeah, question. Okay. I'm going to actually be getting to that in just a little bit, so why don't I talk about that when we get there. All right. Why don't I move on, because I want to make sure I can actually get through all my slides. So here are some of the common file system corruptions, and this is sort of, the first one is probably the most benign, which is just simply any inaccuracies in the block bitmaps or number of free inodes, so the basic accounting information. This sort of stuff is done primarily in pass 5 and is utterly benign. FSK will just simply do it automatically and not abort the boot sequence, for example. I will say, though, that if you're running a file system that has inaccurate block bitmaps, that can actually lead to much worse file system corruptions. For example, if a block is marked as being free when in fact it's really being used by some inode, then the file system could get confused and try to allocate that block for some other file, in which case that block is now pointed to by two inodes, right? And in that case, one of the inodes will contain corrupt data, and FSK will try to deal with it, but you will have data loss in that case. And that's an example of why it's a really good idea. Even though pass 5 errors can be fixed up automatically, you don't want to run a file system that's known to be corrupt because it can actually cause worse corruptions down the line. Yep. It can be caused by any number of things. If it's EXT2, it certainly can be caused by being switched off at the wrong time. It could be caused by memory errors. It could be caused by disk errors. It could be caused by, that pesky NVIDIA module has, corrupted random kernel memory again. There are any number of causes. So you can't really automatically figure out what necessarily caused the problem. And that's sometimes kind of frustrating and kind of scary. So those are some of those. We've already talked about the lost and found. It's up to the system administrator to figure out what in the world to actually do with them. Directories are the easiest thing to figure out what to do because you can just simply ls, #12345 and see what the contents are. And the names in the directory is usually a pretty strong hint where that directory originally started from. A nice tip that you can use is you can use the locate command. Right, locate file name, and then they'll give you the list of path names where that file name might have concern, and that's actually a pretty good way of figuring out where a directory might have originally come from. If you have a file, basically there's not a whole lot you can do. You can use the file command to figure out what the file type is. Is it a .c file? Is it an MP3 file? But then after that point, there's not, basically what you would have to do is you can, see if there's ID3 information if it's an MP3 file. If it's a video file, you might have to, look at the video file and try to figure out what it is. So there isn't a whole lot you can really do there. Hopefully, most of the times, you won't have that many orphaned inodes that are actually in the top-level lost and found. They'll be in subdirectories, and the subdirectories are much, much easier to classify. If you have directory entries that are pointing at invalid inodes, basically inodes that have been deleted, or inodes that have been trashed, FSK will just simply delete them. The system administrator will have to figure out how to actually recover those files, either by going to backups. Very often, if it's a system disk, just simply based on statistics, very often it may very well end up being a system file. In which case you may be able to reload the appropriate RPM file or dpackage file to recover from some lost MySQL file or Apache file or what have you. Blocks claimed by multiple inodes, as I mentioned, this is generally caused by bad block bitmaps. And this is the one place where FSCK will do a whole lot of extra work if it finds these blocks that are claimed by multiple inodes. And that's pass 1B, pass 1C, and pass 1D. These passes can take quite a lot of memory. If you're using a modern FSCK, which is everybody except for those people using Debian obsolete, Debian stable, it's basically order n log n. If you're using Debian obsolete, it's order n cubed. You want to use a relatively new version of FSCK, and Debian stable is the only one that's antique enough to actually have that problem. Normally the number of blocks that will, number of inodes that would be affected is usually pretty small. Usually it's only two or three. The one time where this can get truly, truly disastrous is if you have a chunk of the inode table written into the wrong place. Or if you have utter and complete garbage written into the inode table. And in that case, you can see a lot of inodes that are affected here. And that's usually a hint that something really bad has happened to the inode table. As I said, usually it's the hardware has written a chunk of the inode table block to the wrong location. And so now you've got these two parts of the inode table that both point at the same blocks. Which FSCK will interpret as this multiple claimed scenario, but it's really caused by the fact that part of your inode table has been overwritten by another part of the inode table. That's generally a hardware problem. It could be a kernel device driver bug, but in practice it's almost always a hardware problem. And you're going to be suffering huge amounts of data loss because part of the inode table has been overwritten. And at that point, you know, basically, did I mention backups? So I've talked about most of this already. The inode table is not redundant, and that's mainly for performance reasons. If you lose the inode table, an inode is 128 bytes. So if you lose a 4K block in the inode table, you